The Hard Shoulder with Ciara Kelly and Shane Coleman on News Talk
with Kia.
Now, Dublin-born journalist and author Jason Corcoran's new book tells the story of leaving Russia after Putin's invasion of Ukraine and the knock-on effects this had on his family, his work, and indeed, overall, the knock-on impact with the mass exodus of people fleeing Russia at that time. Jason Corcoran's book is called Leaving Russia, How Putin Forced a Country's Future to Flee. He joins us now in studio. Jason, thanks indeed for coming in to us. Can I start with the introduction of the book? You talk about sitting at home with your young son back in Ireland. I think you're playing Jenga, and then you get a text message. Just tell us that story.
So at the time, my son was 3 years of age, and as most three-year-olds, they require your undivided attention. So we were playing Jenga, and my phone started buzzing, and I was very busy because I'd come back after the full-scale invasion, and I was working, you know, left, right and centre for media in Ireland, the US and the UK. And I assumed there was another request or something. And it turned out it was a warning on Telegram, the Russian encrypted app, saying, Jason, where are you now? Are you in Moscow? And I thought it was Denise. There was this contact I was trying to get in touch with in Moscow for a story about sanctions. And they said, no, it's not Denise. And he said, we are monitoring your reporting. We are not impressed. And you are having security issues right now. And I was shocked. I thought, well, maybe it's a crank. Maybe it's a former colleague trying to wind me up. But at the same time, I thought this could be real. Because at that time, there was foreign journalists who were still operating in Russia who were being arrested, namely Evan Gerskovich from the Wall Street Journal. He was held hostage in very unpleasant circumstances in Lefortovo prison in Moscow for a year.
It made you think twice about returning to Russia. It also made your wife, who is Russian herself, it made her think twice about returning home.
Yeah, she had plans to go back for some family events and she promptly cancelled them. I didn't want to go back because I felt a journalist, you know, and somebody at the time I was a consultant and I was moving back into journalism, having worked as a journalist for 20 years and suddenly I was in demand and I would have gone back as somebody not affiliated to a media organisation. And even Evan, with the power of the Wall Street Journal, he was a hostage effectively for a year.
So Russia was a cold place for a journalist to operate?
You know, we had a really good time. So I arrived in 2006 and there was some fantastic reporting opportunities. And we assumed, you know, our phones were being tapped, but we were left alone, apart from when we went down to the Caucasus. So that's where it was really sensitive, in Chechnya and Dagestan. But otherwise, foreign journalists were left alone and allowed to report on pretty much everything and to be critical of the Russian government up until 2022. That's when things changed.
You write in the book about how 100 years before that, in I think it was 1921, there was a few shiploads of intellectuals who were effectively exiled by Vladimir Lenin. He didn't want them around. And you draw an analogy between those intellectuals who are forced to live in Prague or Zurich or whatever, between them and what happened after the Ukraine war, because you believed it was more of a self-imposed exile by a lot of people after that.
So the rhetoric that was used by Vladimir Ilya Lenin and Vladimir Putin was actually just strangely, eerily similar. Putin was calling for the self-purification of Russian society to get rid of the troublemakers, the creatives, the musicians, the innovators. And that's exactly what happened 100 years ago. So the White Russians, as they were called, they were kind of nobility.
White Russia after the other side in the Civil War.
So the Red Army was against the whites. And there was a revolution in 1917. And then the communists came in and it made it clear these guys were not welcome. So Lenin organized two philosopher ships and pushed them out. And they fled to the four corners of the world. And you had, like, remarkably, you had, like, people like Nabokov, the writer of Lolita, who he left on the last ship out of Sevastopol. And then you had Sergei Rachmaninoff, the famous composer. He got a sled into Helsinki.
Wow. And there was a very famous Russian who came to Ireland as well.
Yeah, so the only white Russian that I could identify who made his way to Ireland, to Dublin, was a chap called Ivan Beshov. So Beshov was on the battleship Potemkin, which organized a mutiny against the Tsar Nikolai II in 1905.
Yeah, very famous film.
Brilliant film made about it,
still famous 100 years later.
It is a classic of the era and well worth a watch. So Beshov took off after the mutiny and he made his way to London, where he met Lenin and he met James Connolly. So he got on very well, James Connolly. And he decided to arrive in Dublin. And he was working in Soviet trade between Ireland and Russia. And then that didn't work out. He got arrested twice. And then he decided, he hit upon the idea of opening a chip shop on the North Strand and eventually moved to Westmoreland Street. And he lived to the ripe age of 103. And I've seen newspaper cuttings of him with Charlie Hawley eating chips in 1987, 40 times.
Fantastic. Now, you follow a director, you follow a musician, an investment banker, a billionaire, entrepreneur, an opposition leader. You followed their stories. They were all people who fled after the war in Ukraine.
Yeah. Well, some fled at 2015, so a year after the annexation of Crimea. That's when the worm, Shane, had really turned, where people were going, okay, the regime is now moving in a certain direction. It's becoming this kleptocratic sort of state and completely lawless. And the repression and the laws that were introduced against dissidents, opposition figures, journalists were becoming really, really egregious.
Okay, you tell the story as well, which I have to say I wasn't aware of. I was kind of surprised when I read it, of Arkady Dvorkovich. Yes, tell us a little bit about him.
So he was a very powerful figure. He was a deputy prime minister under Dmitry Medvedev, who ruled from 2008, 2012.
Ruled in inverted commas. Yeah, Putin was still pulling
exactly.
the strings.
Well, we wanted to think the best. You know, we thought maybe he had a shot. And Medvedev wanted to stay, but Putin, you know, came back and it was a Rocky Rovka castling. So they reverted, you know, president, prime minister, and back again. But, you know, so there was a time when there was a liberal flowering. We thought actually Russia was going to become a member of, you know, a partner with the West, a reliable partner. And like all these liberals like Dvorkovich were part of that. So when the invasion happened in 2022, Dvorkovich gave an interview to Mother Jones, a US publication. And he was mildly critical of the special military operation. And then suddenly the rumor mill was going into overdrive. Arkady has gone missing. Arkady's in Dubai. Arkady's in the gulag. Arkady's been shot. And then lo and behold, he shows up 2 weeks later at a party. And at this party, for his 50th birthday party, there's these guys with the Z t-shirts. And then he gives a new interview to Mother Jones and he recants his earlier position. So that was a shot across the bow.
So what were the Z t-shirts being?
Z for victory.
For victory.
Victory,
okay.
Z, right. Yeah, Zapabedu.
Okay, of course.
And so all of these other liberals who were thought, okay, we better shut up or otherwise, you know, our fate.
Sent out a signal. Yeah. You also make the point that a lot of those people who, and hugely successful people in their fields who fled Russia, found it hard to be welcomed anywhere. Why do you think that was?
Yeah, I think with some places there was an inherent suspicion of Russians and exiles. And you've seen, you know, hybrid attacks. You've seen sleeper cells in the UK and on the continent. It's not been the case in Ireland. My wife hasn't encountered any Russophobia, really any institutional or any personal Russophobia. In fact, she's been welcomed. And, you know, behind the scenes, a lot of Russians that I know have been helping Ukrainians to find accommodation, to put them up and to find them work.
You also make the point that it would be the best way to undermine Putin's war effort would be to welcome these people, these exiles, with open arms.
Yeah. You know, like, you can see why Ukrainians have very mixed views on this. Zelensky at the start of the war said all Russians against the war should leave because their taxes would pay for the war machine. But then a few months later, he said, listen, no Russians should be welcome in the West. They shouldn't be given tourist visas and they should stay at home until they force the regime to change their mind.
Yeah.
But you can see their point of view. But, you know, I'm looking at it from a different point.
I'm not sure about collective responsibility. Yeah. I don't know what an individual can do against a regime as powerful as that. You talk in the book about 2008, and you've kind of touched on this, that kind of sense of optimism that was there when Medvedev came in, and then you talk about the European Championships, and there was this young, very exciting Russian team that got to the semi-finals and kind of captured the imagination. But obviously that hope vanquished over time. Do you have any hope about Russia's future, or do you think it is, I suppose, doomed to a succession of strong leaders that you can trace back to Stalin, to Chernenko, to Lenin, to Brezhnev, and various other leaders?
You know, I think there's a generation will be gone. And I think that realistically, if Putin is removed, if there is a palace coup, if he's hit by a Ukrainian drone, which he fears increasingly, the most likely thing is there will be another extremist who comes in. But there could be an extremist, Shane, who comes in, who decides he wants to do a deal because he misses his holidays in Saint-Tropez. His mistress misses going to Monaco, to Paris on shopping trips to see Beyonce. And they will want to see an easing of sanctions because sanctions are crippling the Russian economy. Twin track economy, you have the military industrial production machine, which is, you know, making out like bandits. And then you have the consumer economy, which is really struggling in, you know, central Moscow, St. Petersburg, all the large cities.
Okay, but as for the future, are you hopeful or are you without hope?
No, I think there's a wonderful sort of pessimistic, fatalistic saying in Russia, "Nadezhda umirает последней," hope dies last. And I knew Alexei Navalny, and he was the great white hope for Russia. Up until he was murdered in the Gulag, we thought that one day we would have a Mandela moment and that he would leave and he would lead Russia to a bright and new future. And, you know, there will be other future leaders and they're in exile at the moment, but it needs a reimagination.
And you don't see yourself ever moving back there to live, do you?
There has to be a regime change for me. The risk is not worthwhile. And we have an Irish, dual Irish-Russian national. You may have heard of this, Dmitry Simbaev. He was living in Galway for 20 years. He went back to Russia in August last year to visit his parents, his elderly parents. And he was seized and he's been accused of promoting extremist material because there was messages on his phone from his wife, who's Ukrainian, who lost her mother in Kharkiv, critical of the war. And he's now been held hostage.
Okay. The book is Leaving Russia, How Putin Forced a Country's Future to Flee. Author Jason Corcoran, thank you so much for talking to The Hard Shoulder today.
Thanks, Shane.
The Hard Shoulder with Ciara Kelly and Shane Coleman.
With Kia.
Weekdays at 4 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.